The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening and welcome to a brand new series of The History Show. On this week's programme, the diaries of Dr. Kathleen Lynn.
She is there when the Commandant, Sean Connolly, is shot dead. She holds him in her arms and she says in the diaries, she knew instantly there was nothing she could do for him. It was a headshot.
What her daily writings reveal about an eventful life. Also, the founding father of artificial intelligence.
Up to that point, the study of computers or machines that could think and do things was generally referred to as automata. He didn't like the term, and he is credited with coining the phrase artificial intelligence.
Andy O'Donoghue joins us to talk about the career of Professor John McCarthy, the son of an Irish immigrant and a Silicon Valley legend. Plus, we'll hear about a project that's using AI to digitise a 19th century Irish language newspaper.
A lot of the history of Ireland that happens to have been printed in Irish is in the Clo Gaeilge. We have a responsibility now to ensure that in our digital age that all of that material is not left behind.
Kathleen Lynn was a radical and a revolutionary, a suffragist, a socialist and a politician. She's known to many people for her participation in the 1916 Rising, but Lynn's battles and campaigns extended far beyond the revolutionary period. Lynn was a pioneering medical professional, a doctor who established and maintained one of Ireland's most important hospitals. Lynn was also a diarist. For nearly four decades before her death in 1955, she kept a daily record of her life, a life spent in the company of her fellow activist, Madeleine French Mullen, and their many friends, a life spent offering care, protection and hope for their many patients. To discuss that life, I'm joined by Dr. Mary McAuliffe, historian, lecturer and director of gender studies at University College Dublin, and Harriet Wheelock, Keeper of Collections at the Royal College of Physicians of Ireland, in whose archives the original diaries are stored. They are co-editors of a new book, The Diaries of Kathleen Lynn, A Life Revealed Through Personal Writing. Mary and Harriet, you're both very welcome indeed to the History Show. Before we discuss the diaries, Harriet, give us a brief account of Kathleen Lynn's life and career up to 1916, if you would.
So Kathleen Lynn, she's born in Mayo. She's educated first at home, then she goes to Alexander College in Dublin. And that's really where she begins to get involved in many of the movements that will dominate later into her life. And it's from influences in her family. There's a doctor in her family who she's very influenced by. And it's through that. And then from, I think, as well, meeting medics when she's in Alexander College, that she decides she wants to train as a doctor herself. She's in kind of the second generation of women who go into medicine in Ireland. So women have been able to access medical education for about 20 years when Lynn begins. And she registers with the Royal College of Science, now part of UCD. And that's where she undertakes her medical training and in hospitals in Dublin, particularly the Adelaide Hospital.
And she also worked, I think, in the Eye and Ear Hospital, didn't
she? Yeah, so immediately after graduation, she gets a job in the Eye and Ear Hospital and she's there until 1916, at which point she loses her position because of her activities.
Now, during that period, Mary, while she's working in the Eye and Ear Hospital, she becomes a member of the Irish Citizens Army.
She does, although that comes out of about a 10-year sort of trajectory of her life from what she admits in the latter part of her diary. She was a soft unionist. And that was very extraordinary for me to see that written down because I had presumed she'd always been maybe a cultural nationalist or a soft nationalist, but actually, given her family background, I suppose it isn't surprising. She is the daughter of a Church of Ireland clergyman, related to the Gorboots of Lissadell and many of that Anglo-Irish upper middle class and ascendancy. So she takes that trajectory from soft unionism through suffrage campaigning to cultural nationalism and then to socialism and joining the Irish Citizen Army in 1913. Firstly, of course, becoming very much involved in providing care for those who were out in the great lockout strike of 1913 through Liberty Hall, and gets to know James Connolly, who always said of Kathleen Lynn that she was the best of us, and really is influenced by Connolly's ideologies and writings, but also about her by her own educational background. But you have to remember as well, in Alexandra College, they had a real ideology of practical philanthropy, of seeing the poverty that was in Dublin. And she was very much engaged in that from a teenage from then and worked through Alexandra College and various groups there to alleviate poverty in the tenements in Dublin. So I think she was a mind already open to ideas of socialism, ideas of poverty alleviation, of better housing for the poor in Dublin, better healthcare, obviously, as a doctor. And that she found a response to that politically through Connolly's writings, through trade union activism, and then her growing nationalism through the Irish Citizen Army.
Tell me then about her experience of the 1916 Rising itself.
Well, she is one of the few people in Dublin, other than somebody like the O'Rahilly, who has a car. And so she delivers a lot of the first aid equipment to the various outposts, to Stephen's Green before they retreated to the College of Surgeons and various other places. And then she is to position herself in what was supposed to be Dublin Castle, but as we know, they didn't take it. Instead, they took City Hall. And apparently she had to climb over the railings to get into City Hall. So the Irish Citizen Army garrison is there before she arrives. And within minutes of her arrival, she's up on the roof and she is there when the commandant, Sean Connolly, no relation to James, is shot dead. She holds him in her arms and she says in the diaries, she knew instantly there was nothing she could do for him. It was a headshot. And he died with her and with Helena Maloney and Jenny Davis, both of whom she had trained in first aid, by his side. Another two officers of the Citizen Army are then killed in the course of the day. So by the time the evening comes and the British have bored their way in through the back wall of City Hall, she's the senior officer and she's the one who gives the surrender on Easter Monday evening. So in effect, her rising lasts about 8 or 9 hours at most. And she spends the rest of the week with the City Hall garrison in Ship Street Barracks, which she gives vivid descriptions of how awful it was. Unhygienic, terrible food. They were mistreated verbally. And there is some hint of mistreatment of the women, particularly when they were using the bathroom, of, you know, doors being taken off and soldiers not giving them privacy. So there's a lot of detail about that experience during the week.
And then what happens to her in the courts martial? Where does she end up after the rising?
Well, she is taken from Ship Street to Kilmainham Jail, where happily, she and Madeline are reunited and they spend a few days there. And now they're there when the executions start. And after about 10 days of the 77 women imprisoned after the rising, almost 70 of them are released. But the more, I suppose, the ones the authorities considered most dangerous are shipped off to Mountjoy, including Markovitch, Kathleen Lynn, and a few others. And she's very upset because even though Mountjoy is nicer than Kilmainham in terms of hygiene, she said she'd give £10,000 for Kilmainham and Madeline, because Madeline and she are separated at that stage. So she spends a short time there. And then there is a decision about what to do with her because they don't want to release her. So she is excluded from Ireland. She's sent to England under DORA regulations and she's supposed to stay there, but she doesn't stay there for very long.
Now, during 1916, that's when she starts to first keep a diary, Harriet, a practice she maintains for the next almost 40 years. The diaries, however, they're written in a kind of an idiosyncratic style. Give us an idea of how they're laid out. What is the style of these diaries?
So
how detailed are they?
Initially, she's in 1916, in the days after the rising, she's writing while in prison. So they're written on scraps of paper, which is presumably all she had. And we have those scraps. And then at some point later, probably around 1918, 1919, she starts transferring those early entries into volumes, which she then continues to use. So unlike a normal diary, when you write the 1st of January and then the 2nd of January and then the 3rd of January, Lynn takes one double page spread for the 1st of January. And the first line is the year 1916. The next line is the year 1917. The next line, the year 1918. So you get about 20 years worth of one day's activities across a page. And then because it's one small line, she's then cramming three or four lines of writing into that space. So they're very short entries. She uses lots of abbreviation. She uses lots of kind of almost like her own code or shorthand to get a huge amount into a very small space. And because of the way she's writing them, there's quite a lot of reflection back, because obviously when she's writing her entries for each day, she's got what happened the previous year and previous years as she goes further in above her. So particularly towards the end of her life, there's a lot of reflection back on key days, you know, 10 years since the rising, 20 years
To be blunt about it, is it a bit of a head wreck?
Yeah, and she does have typical Dr. Tan writing. There's no way around it. Working in the college archives, I could probably say that. She has very, very difficult to read handwriting. Also, in the early years, her house was being raided. She probably didn't want it to make it too easy for people to read what she was writing. Very, very hard to read.
Okay. And Mary, given the complexity of the source material, and there's so much material, you have 40 years of material here, describe the editing process.
Well, we were very lucky in that the handwritten diaries have been transcribed and they were done. And I don't know how she did it, but all credit is due to her, to Margaret Connolly, who did
now,
it.
Saint Margaret Connolly.
Saint Margaret Connolly, yes. Who did it over 2 or 3 years?
3 years, yeah.
3 years. And she said it was like unpicking knitwear or something like that, that she concentrated on each word. So sometimes the sentences to her lost context. It was just the word. But we did measure just to test. And she absolutely got everything right as far as we could see. So we had those texts, but it's almost a million words of a diary. So we couldn't publish a million words, but we didn't want to lose Lynn's personality, her voice, what was important to her, the different things she was involved in, whether politics or medical, her medical profession or healthcare or traveling around the world or the relationship with Madeline. And then the network of women that she was involved in and all sorts of different pieces of activism over the years. So we took our time and over the process, and luckily we were doing this through COVID as well, so there was time. We did several different editings of it, at least four. We decided to keep each entry complete. Mm. We weren't going to shorten the entries because that is her staccato rhythm. Is the way I think of it. It's her voice coming at you each day. And then there were periods when we know she's in Glenmalure every August. So nothing much happens there except they're down there having their holidays. So we can include a number of entries for that in each year, but we don't have to include a lot because they are just having a good time and having fun. But it's interesting to see who comes and visits them and their relationships with the local people, which were excellent. But we really wanted to keep her work as a doctor, her work in St. Dalton's, and the fact that the fundraising they had to do to keep that going, the fights, obviously, around the time of the amalgamation with Harcourt Street, which unfortunately didn't happen, her work as a local councillor, her interest in social housing and better education and public hygiene and healthcare, the doctors in St. Dalton's, which is really a female space, which is very interesting. You don't get that about medical histories very much, because most hospitals, although a lot of them are founded by nuns, the doctors are men. So this is a female space where you have female doctors, female nurses. You would have men working there, but mostly they're janitorial staff. The innovations they introduced to St. Dalton's, they start out with two cots, £70 in the bank, and a couple of goats. And I found the idea of the goats very interesting because they are providing goat's milk for the children who maybe might be allergic to breast milk or dairy milk. Just, and I hope, and I think we did manage to keep who and what Kathleen Lynn was by, we only have 10% of the diaries really in the book, but I think it gives a real sense of who she was in her entirety.
Looking at the diaries, one of the things that struck me was the number of references, and they're all necessary. There are no superfluous references. You've got to kind of, you as editors have to decipher who's she talking about? What is she talking about? What does she mean?
Oh, yeah, because she just throws in names. Sometimes it's a surname. Sometimes it's a nickname. Sometimes it's Mr. This or Mrs. That. And we had to figure out who they were from their names, the context in which he's writing. And newspapers were invaluable for that, as were other archives. So we went and looked at other archives, who people were talking about, what was happening at this time, why would she be interacting with these people, what are the newspapers saying. And we had to do an awful lot of work around that. And the other archives in the physicians were invaluable, weren't they?
Yeah, particularly for the medics, because there's a lot of staff going through the hospital and she talks about them all. So working out who they were, mostly from their name and the date, the medical registers, you can pick them up. And then internationally as well, because she has a lot of links. They're traveling, they're going to America, they're going to Europe, they're meeting with the leading doctors at the time, they're bringing back ideas. And she talks about all of that in the diary.
Tell me, Mary's already mentioned St. Alton's Hospital, St. Alton's Hospital for Sick Infants, co-founded in 1919. Tell us a little bit about that hospital.
Yeah, so the hospital was set up really, it's kind of the bridge between the maternity hospitals and then sort of hospitals for older children. So they're taking children between 2 and 5, well, up to 2 years old, and then later they push it up to 5 years. And it's on Charlemont Street. It was right in the centre of the kind of really deprived areas in Dublin. And they were providing medical care, obviously, but they were providing a huge amount of social care as well. They did lots of things. They provided what we now sort of be, they had an almoner, so they were doing social work. They were providing food. They were providing education to mothers and how to look after their children.
At a time when mortality rates were
incredibly
very, very high.
Yeah. And there's a photograph album in the archive from St. Alton's where they take pictures for the first 2 or 3 years of the hospital, and they take pictures of all the patients coming in, and most of the babies that are coming in are severely malnourished, and you can see that. And there's a picture of them when they're leaving as well, so you can see the changes that the hospital's having. And they really create a community. They have a party every year where they invite back what they call our children, so all their patients are invited back. They keep track on them as they grow older. They have one early patient who becomes a champion Irish dancer, so he's always appearing in pictures in the annual report saying, look how well our babies are doing now. There's a real sense of community, and it's not just, it's the whole child. It's not just
the illness.
Yeah,
I mean, there was a philosophy, wasn't there?
Yeah, it was very much about the whole child. They introduce education. So Maria Montessori comes to visit the hospital in the 30s. They have a Montessori teacher in the hospital, particularly when they start taking in TB patients who are there for longer. They obviously need to provide educational support for them. They introduce vaccination. There's, you know, really revolutionary ideas, and often against a fair amount of opposition.
And Mary St. Alton's a remarkable success story, but she, Kathleen Lynn, very, very farsighted. She wants to create a national children's hospital, doesn't she?
She does. Now, the suggestion does come initially from the hospital sweepstakes, and they're very lucky. They're one of the hospitals that is getting funding from the sweepstakes during this time. And it does help them a bit, because before that, they were doing all sorts of things for funding, saints days and at homes and all of that. So that helps them a lot. So Harcourt Street, which is also a secular hospital, and St. Alton's were seen as the two that should come together to create a national children's hospital. Michael Scott, the architect, now famed for many of his designs, had been a good friend and had designed things for a number of additions onto the St. Alton's, and indeed the famous balcony on Kathleen's own house that she spent a lot of time on. Great admirer of fresh air, believed in it totally, and sunshine. And he designed this beautiful hospital that would have stretched from Charlemont Street Bridge to, I think, Rathmines Bridge. Yeah. And this whole idea was to create a big hospital which would incorporate all the innovative ideas that Lynn had brought in, enough beds to, you know, service basically the city and the country, and they could grow from there. And they started buying up land all around Charlemont Street to create that. However, opposition came, and came very strongly from the Archbishop of Dublin, Edward Byrne, and his right-hand man, John Charles McQuaid, his successor, and the Catholic doctors and secular conservative Catholic allies of the church. And that opposition put paid to it. Basically, they felt that every hospital in the country needed to have a Catholic ethos and be staffed by doctors trained through the Catholic system, and not be a secular hospital where there might be, God forbid, sex education, information on contraceptives, proselytization, all of that sort of thing, which they were accused of potentially maybe doing if the hospital went ahead. They did have a meeting with Archbishop Byrne. Lynn says in her diaries he was very superior to them, you know, just totally dismissed them, didn't listen to any of their arguments, and the whole plan just fizzled out. I mean, being a very practical woman, she does return to it every so often and was very disappointed it never happened. But she moves on then, and they start the vaccination programme, the BCG, with Dr. Dorothy Stopford Price leading it. There was opposition to that too as well, but they got that going. But I think the fact that Lynn led this idea of the new National Children's Hospital really kind of supports the idea we should call the one that's being, if it's ever built, constructed right now, after her.
Indeed. The diaries make clear, Harriet, that she had a large social network to rely upon, particularly her life partner, Madeleine French Mullen. Tell us a little bit about that relationship, if you would.
Yeah, so Lynn and French Mullen, they meet before the diary starts, so they meet in
1913, 14. About 1913, 14. We're not quite sure when, but sometime around then.
Apparently, Lynn is teaching first aid to a group of Cumnabon women, and Madeline French Mullen falls off her seat laughing at something, and Lynn picks her up, and it's all good from there. So they're living together in the house in Rathmines, and you really get a sense in the diaries of how many people there are coming through the house. Like both families, although Lynn does have trouble with her family immediately after 1916, later on, so things do clear out. Madeline's family are very present there. They go and visit each other. Lynn's aunt Florence appears frequently in the diary, and then all their friends, joint friends as well. And it's interesting when Mary was looking at people referring to them, they're always referred to together. It's always mm-hmm. the doctor and Madeline. They come, they are seen in their circle as a couple. And, you know, people come to visit them as a couple. And then after Madeline dies, it does change. And it's different friends coming through. She still has her old friends, although Lynn talks a lot, particularly as she ages, about how sad it is that funerals are the place where you see all your friends. But she has new generations of her family, the younger generations that she's clearly very close to. And there is a lot of support and love and friendship in her life, I think.
Yes, she never stops missing Madeline.
Yeah.
She's incredibly well connected, which I think makes these diaries of huge social importance, mm-hmm. historical importance, rather than just being examples of, for a couple of years, revolutionary history and then medical history.
Oh, absolutely. And she does continue to be a very politically aware and politically active player in many ways. For instance, she is very much part of the campaign against inserting the Women in the Home articles into the 1937 Constitution. So she remains very well connected with all the suffrage women. Hannah Shee Skeffington, of course, is a neighbour in the last decades of their lives. And they have a bit of a falling out over Hannah leaving Sinn Féin to join Fianna Fáil, but then they make it up within a year. She knows every leading female activist and most of the male political activists, social activists, medical doctors, certainly in Dublin and probably in the country. She herself is a very well-known person, and she continues to be very active in all those areas. You know, social housing is a huge issue of hers. So herself and Madeline are on the Rathmines Urban District Council. They campaign for social housing and end up, again, Michael Scott designing, getting the Charlemont Street flats built, which are really a replacement for the tenements and a very forward-thinking design of what you can do to create proper social housing. So those connections stay with her all of her life. You can see even to the last few months of her life when she's writing her last entries, she's talking about being tired, but she's still very engaged in what's going on. So, you know, her network of friends and her network of political allies overlap a huge amount.
And for all the reasons that we've heard, the Kathleen Lynn National Children's Hospital has an appropriate ring to it, doesn't it?
Oh, I think so. Absolutely. You know, this was a woman who dedicated her life to the health and well-being of infants and children, found innovative technologies, ensured that she did what she could to make sure the infant mortality rates were coming down. You can see in the diaries she loved every one of her patients. She meant if one of them failed to thrive and if they died, she mourns them in the diaries. And as Harriet said, they had this whole child ideology in St. Alton's Hospital, led by Kathleen. And I think no better woman to have the National Children's Hospital named after.
Absolutely. Dr. Mary McAuliffe and Harriet Wheelock, many thanks for joining us on The History Show this evening to talk about the diaries of Kathleen Lynn, A Life Revealed Through Personal Writing, published by UCD Press. After the break, we'll be looking at the origins of AI and the life of the Irish-American professor who coined the term artificial intelligence. Stay with us. Artificial intelligence is a field at the forefront of technological innovation and societal transformation. We're going to look now at the life and contributions of a man known as one of the founding fathers of AI, Professor John McCarthy. He was a visionary who laid the groundwork for the technology revolution that we're witnessing today. He's credited with coining the term artificial intelligence, naming the frontier of research that he helped to pioneer. To talk about the life and work of this Irish-American computer scientist, I'm joined by technology journalist Andy O'Donoghue. Andy, let's begin with Silicon Valley, that epicentre of US tech innovation, and it was the place where McCarthy spent most of his career. How did it develop? Because I think a lot of the technology of California actually started in Southern California and then worked its way up to what we know as Silicon Valley now.
I think that's pretty much it, Miles. And I suppose it's often been said that the gold rush perhaps has something to do even with the state of mind of Northern California. But I think unquestionably it did start in Southern California. And if you look right back to the 20s and the 30s, and the blue skies of California were attractive. And one of the things that started to happen there was the aviation industry. And it was really good for flying. So you had a lot of things that started happening. People were building aircraft there. You had Lockheed and you had Grumman and other companies who were able to test fly aircraft. They were able to build aircraft. And part of what happened, or part of the story then, was that they started to win defense contracts, US Department of Defense contracts. So you're talking about kind of the 30s and the 40s, obviously the war, and then you had the Cold War. And that intensification around Cold War activity, the space race started to happen. So you had all of this kind of this ideal sort of context. And Eisenhower created NASA and DARPA, which is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And that was kind of a trigger, because what happened in Southern California was you needed engineers, you needed mathematicians, you needed scientists, you needed people to support those companies. So you had this defense industry growing up in Southern California, kind of spilled over a bit into Northern California. And I think 1939, Hewlett-Packard, who, you know, we've all had some of their printers or devices in our homes over the years, that was formed, but that was very much
the garage where it all started is still preserved to this day.
It is.
Drive past it.
It is. And Hewlett-Packard, of course, was the first real Silicon Valley company. But then a big thing happened. Shockley Semiconductor was started in what we now call Silicon Valley, Palo Alto. Sometime later, it didn't last very long as a company, but a group of scientists called the Treacherous Eight spun themselves out, as we would say these days, and founded Fairchild Semiconductor. And that was the real signal for Silicon Valley to start.
And how important in all of this was the presence of the University of Stanford?
Stanford was incredibly important, absolutely crucial to Silicon Valley, because, of course, that's where the scientists, the engineers and the mathematicians were coming from. And, of course, they were close to the companies who were being started. And Stanford very cleverly early on realized academics always love grants, and even to this day. And so they identified the opportunity to get government grants. And I think even up to the 70s, I mean, it was more than 50% of industrial R&D in the US was funded by the government. And it was for, of course, the space race defense work. And an interesting thing happened in 1951, and the Stanford Industrial Park was founded. And they had a very, the head of Stanford at the time was essentially a visionary. And we now know what a business park is. But in 1951, that was a big call to make. And so they took this land, they created a business park. And within a decade, there were dozens of companies, thousands of people working there, all supported by Stanford. And Stanford, to this day, of course, remains incredibly important in the computer business. And we have the founders of Google went there, the founders of lots of other companies. And of course, Hewlett and Packard both attended Stanford also.
Tell us about McCarthy's background and about his parents, because he is very, very, very much an Irish-American.
He is. I often think that he's the greatest Irish-American that we don't really know much about. His father was from Cremahon in County Kerry. And the story goes that he sold a cow or cattle to fund his departure from South Kerry. He moved to the US and he met a woman called Ida Glatt, who was a Lithuanian and a journalist. She is often part of the John McCarthy story. She's often forgotten, but she was a remarkable woman. She was a suffragette. She attended Goucher College. And there's some interesting archive material about her specifically being named. And the head of Goucher College at the time, I believe, wrote asking her and her suffragette colleagues not to protest at the White House. And but 30 of them did. And she was a socialist and she was very active. She would attend, it was said that she would attend within 200 miles. She would attend every conference that she could. She brought justice and socialist kind of conscience to her circle at Goucher. She married John Patrick McCarthy, or Jack McCarthy as he was known. John McCarthy, the scientist, was then born in 1927.
And he was, as a child, wasn't in the best of health. And I think isn't that what prompted the move to the West Coast?
That is, yeah. And he was kind of a sickly child, incredibly clever. He says even that his interest in mathematics started before he was in high school. He then attended Caltech as a student, was a very good student. Even there's an interesting interview that I watched with him some years ago, and he talks about becoming interested in artificial intelligence in 1949. And he attended some computer programming classes before there were computers. So his interest in mathematics spilled over very quickly into computing as soon as it was available.
And just in case people are not impressed with Caltech, Caltech is the California Institute of Technology, and I think it is, and has been for the last number of years, the number one institute of third level learning in the world. So, I mean, it's up there with the Harvards and the Yales and the Stanfords and the Berkeleys of this world. And I mean, tell me about then his education after that, because I think he went back east. He went to Princeton, didn't he?
He did. He had a remarkable education. He attended Caltech, then got his BS in mathematics. He then moved to Princeton, he says, because Princeton was simply the best place for mathematics. And he was very much initially a mathematician, got his PhD in mathematics, was an assistant professor at Stanford for a while, but I think he says that they had three professors and they needed two. So he moved away and he came back, though. Stanford was very much his spiritual home because of all the reasons we've talked about and because of the way technology was moving. And so he moved back and would eventually found SAILE, the Stanford Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. And he is credited with coining the phrase artificial intelligence. And up to that point, the study of computers or machines that could think and do things was generally referred to as automata. And he didn't like the term. He liked to think about the future and had done so for years. So he conceived with a number of colleagues the Dartmouth Conference, which was held, I think, in 1956.
That's in Dartmouth College.
In Dartmouth College. And he conceived this conference and he wrote to a number of people asking them to attend. He thought that 11 would turn up. As it happened, 20 attended the conference. But he complained a little bit that he had asked the Rockefeller Foundation for funding and they gave him half the money for the conference that he thought they would. But 20 people turned up. And you think, Miles, I mean, it's over 80 years ago or close to 80 years ago that he coined that phrase. And of course, he remains to this day one of perhaps the four people who kind of introduced the concept of artificial intelligence to us.
Is he as important as somebody like Alan Turing, for example, or in a very different area, someone like Oppenheimer?
Yeah, he certainly is an important as Alan Turing. Actually, he received the Turing Award, and as well as the Kyoto Award and a number of others. But he is, and he was very much, I think, there's a number of characters, and they are pillars in a sense. So his work was very much as important as Turing. He was asked about artificial intelligence and when we would have human-level intelligence. And he said it could be hundreds of years. But back in the 80s, he said, however, if I was willing to bet, I would say about 50. And of course, he's not far off. And one of the things he did is he created a number of things. So the Lisp programming language, which is the language that is used for artificial intelligence programming. He conceived that, which was very important. And then he created a type of logic that relates to the number of inputs or the data that we use to make decisions. And he uses an example about a birdcage. If I asked you to build me a birdcage for my bird, you would make the assumption that my bird can fly and you need to put a roof on it. But if you found out that my bird was a penguin, you, and this is the example McCarthy uses, if you found out it's a penguin, you don't need a roof. So this type of logic he thought was incredibly important for artificial intelligence. And of course, many of your listeners will have tried things like ChatGPT over the last year or so. And of course, we now realize what McCarthy was talking about was the prompts that we use. So what he did was he conceived how we contextualize what we tell a computer so that it can make a proper decision based on the data that it receives.
He's also credited with at least accelerating the development of the internet and the cloud.
Well, the cloud, two interesting things. And Stanford, of course, was very important. And the first precursor, I suppose, to the internet was ARPANET. And one of the first nodes, there was four of them. The first one was a connection between Stanford and UCLA, also in California. So it is not surprising that McCarthy was close to that when that was created. But he also came up with this idea of time sharing. And time sharing at the time, because computers were big and they were expensive, and he conceived the idea where over the following decades, we would all have access to information in our homes. We would have it when we wanted it. And that would be achieved by computers being time shared. And so when we look back now, we realize that what McCarthy was actually talking about was the cloud. So in a sense, his concept of time sharing is exactly what the cloud has become.
Something I would have thought would have alarmed, although he preceded him, I suppose, it would have alarmed a namesake of McCarthy, one Joseph McCarthy, was that our McCarthy had an interest in the Soviet Union.
He did, and in fact he talks about a book, a Russian book, that informed him about a lot of science when he was a boy. And his parents, whilst Ida Glatt was a socialist, his parents really did become communists and atheists. And McCarthy was influenced by not only their kind of, particularly his mother's kind of yearning for social justice, but he was influenced by their politics early on. Although he does appear to have gone full circle and became quite a conservative Republican towards the end of his life. But he did, and he was certainly influenced by their politics in his early life.
I mean, he was probably fortunate that he wasn't that active in the early 50s and was more active later on in the decade. Also fascinated by chess.
He was fascinated by chess. And 1968, he proposed the idea that within 10 years, a computer would be able to beat a grandmaster of chess. And he had a Scottish colleague who in 1978, he challenged this idea to. And his colleague won two games versus the computer's one. So McCarthy says that he was wrong, but when we look back now, he really wasn't that far out.
Did he come into his own? Was he fortunate that he came into his own at the right time, that he was shaped by what was, in retrospect now, a transformative era?
He was absolutely there at the right time. Like many of those people related to artificial intelligence and to computing and the likes of Hewlett and Packard. But I think what's interesting about McCarthy is that he was drawn, in a sense, you know, it sounds trite to say he was drawn to where the action was, but he was absolutely in the right place. We talked about his education from Princeton. He also spent time at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He went to all the right places. What is fascinating about him is that he had the vision and the brilliance and the open-mindedness to realize in 1949 that computing wasn't going to be enough. This was before he had access to a computer. He realized that this was the future. And he worked very hard throughout his life to not only achieve his own academic goals, but also, he gave a lot to the world through his work.
And was he one of those American professors who never retire? They never seem to retire.
He never did retire. He ended up as Professor Emeritus. You know, he worked very hard and he wrote and he became, I suppose we were talking about his politics, he became, some would say, controversial, but he spoke about various topics over the years, from the Middle East to environmentalism, to politics. You know, he had been through that era, and particularly there was a lot of, you know, from the student protests in the 70s, McCarthy worked with a lot of people involved in the computer business, would have a huge influence on them. They were, many of them were his students, but he was also very socially aware of not only California and America, but also the world.
Well, certainly a McCarthy that Irish Americans can be more proud of than his namesake, Joseph McCarthy. That's John McCarthy we're talking about, Professor John McCarthy, an extraordinary thinker whose influence continues to resonate today. And obviously with his Kerry roots, we are going to claim him as one of our own. My guest is technology journalist Andy O'Donoghue. Andy, many thanks indeed for joining us.
Thank you, Miles.
After the break, we'll be staying with artificial intelligence as we hear about an exciting project which is using AI technology to digitise the world's first Irish language newspaper. Stay with us. Welcome back. Did you know that the first Irish language newspaper in the world was not published in Ireland, but in New York? It was called An Gael. And when it was founded in 1881, there were hundreds of thousands of native Irish speakers living in the city. Right now, an ongoing project aims to create a fully digital, searchable edition of the newspaper, comprising 2,200 pages, published over two decades in the late 19th century. To achieve this, researchers are using AI to decipher old newsprint, a task somewhat complicated by the fact that it's printed in the Clogaelic, the old Irish typeface, which is now rarely used. Our producer, Lorcan Clancy, found out more.
Micheál Olócán, the founding editor of An Gael, was an ambitious man. His newspaper, at its peak, had 3,000 subscribers, but he envisioned a much larger audience.
When I was correcting pages of it, I came across a phrase where he talked about having to have the million readers yet, that their aspiration was to keep growing to the point that there might be a million readers. And in a sense, you could say that he's already achieved that milestone. You know, there have been a million tweets as Gaeilge already. Now with running OCR on this paper and the models that are being produced through this project, they themselves will be applied to other documents. And who's to say that the models themselves won't have served a million readers in time?
Olócán's ambition was matched by his energy. An emigrant from Milltown, County Galway, he arrived in New York in 1871 and quickly became a leading voice in the nascent Gaelic revival, promoting the Irish language. His newspaper was bilingual, featuring articles in Irish and in English, and sometimes material with translations, allowing readers to enhance their proficiency in Irish.
My name is Deirdre Nichonela. I'm Associate Research Scholar at Glucksman Ireland House, New York University. When we look at the span of An Gael and the commitment that Micheál Olócán showed, and then we look at the content of the paper as well, he really was driven, absolutely driven, to deliver this organ to the community of Irish speakers and, in a sense, to the Irish people. He would refer to Aid o' War, a Greater Ireland, to signal that there were Irish speakers at home in Ireland, but actually, in that latter part of the 19th century, 40% of the world's Irish speakers were outside of Ireland. And so when he says Aid o' War, that's what he's talking about, is Irish speakers everywhere.
The project is using OCR technology, that's optical character recognition, to interpret and digitise the newsprint. With humans checking and correcting its work, over time, the computer gets better at recognising the text accurately.
And one of the key challenges is that historically, Irish was written and printed with two different scripts or two typefaces, in a sense. Nowadays, we see Roman letters just like we use for English or French or German. And in computers, of course, that's the general typeface that's used. But of course, historically, Irish also had its own Clogaelic or Irish script. And this was used right up until the 1960s. So people might be familiar with it from seeing it on post boxes, shop fronts or pub walls. My own father, for instance, when he was going to school, would have learned how to read and write Irish using the Clogaelic. But when I was going to school, we had switched to Roman lettering. So it's not too difficult to learn, even though it's not being taught in schools or in colleges, really, because most of the letters are quite similar to the Roman alphabet. But there's a few key differences between them, and it's been fun to try and teach this to computers and teach computers how to read it.
Some of those key differences. The G's, they look a bit like S's. The C's and T's are also similar. As it learns, the AI-powered technology starts to discern these subtle differences.
Michal Olohan, he was conscious that many of the potential readers for the paper were just developing their literacy in Irish. So he even printed the Clo Gaelic alphabet, and there's a little table and even the pronunciation of how to say the alphabet in Irish, O, B, K, D, A, F, G. So there's a sort of a proselytising effort nearly, and they're teaching people and also promoting nationalism as well, trying to, I suppose, raise the profile of the Irish and improve their profile as well. A lot of the history of Ireland that happens to have been printed in Irish is in the Clo Gaelic, and we have a responsibility now to ensure that in our digital age that all of that material is not left behind. So the UnGael project is supported to date by several funders, the Robert Gardner Foundation based in Long Island in New York, the Irish Institute of New York, Glucksman Ireland House and the University of Galway. With the support of those funders, we have got as far as correcting half of all of the pages to date. So there's 2,290 pages in the entire paper. So we're halfway through correcting them. All the Gaeilge pages have been corrected. And we just have a little bit more work to do to ensure that the entire data set is corrected. And at that point, we'll be making an interface available for people to search.
Deirdre is working on this along with project leader Nicholas Wolfe, an historian of the Irish language, and data scientist Oksana Dereza.
And then I'm bringing expertise as an ethnomusicologist and a cultural historian, and I'm very familiar with the milieu that is captured in the paper. And so I'm the one who's leading the correction piece and going from page to page and word to word to check for accuracy. And when you've got a small team like that, there's fantastic collaboration between the three of us. And a real learning has been that it's no good the whole world being coding experts. You need historians, you need language and linguistics expertise as well to produce the tools for the future. If it were left solely to the maybe computing side of it, you just won't get the functionality that you need. So we need to understand history in context if we're going to create these new tools. Our team works remotely as well. So I have been working on this from my home in the Aran Islands. And I think that would be hugely pleasing to Michal Olohan to know that in a sense this has come home to Galway for its next chapter.
And that was Dr. Deirdre Ní Conaille ending that report on the ongoing project to digitise the Irish language newspaper UnGael. That's all we've time for on this evening's programme. Details of all our items as well as podcasts are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. My thanks tonight to Liam Mullen and Damien Chanel on sound and our researcher, Ian Kennelly. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.